Ecclesiastes, it's there close to Proverbs, after the book of Proverbs. We have finished the foundation study. We are about 2 weeks ahead of the others, give or take. So I'm going to fill the time with a couple of lessons from the book of Ecclesiastes. They'll stand on their own. It's not my intent to keep studying because other topics are being planned, but this one can stand on its own and let us make some good commentary, if you will. C.S. Lewis makes a statement in his writing, The Screwtape Letters, as he's giving instruction to Wormwood, his nephew, on the art of tempting. And he says, teach him to call it real life and don't let him ask what he means by real. And that speaks to something we're talking about in our sermon this morning about false teachers, but it fits the book of Ecclesiastes. Warren Wiersbe calls it the good life. He gives it that topic. And it's a midlife crisis, although it's not the middle of his life. It's later than that. But it's Solomon reflecting on life as he sees it, as he uses his wisdom and experience and wealth. And he is evaluating life. First, he looks at it with God out of the picture, and then God will be inserted into the picture. And those who study this book are in conflict a lot of times because it doesn't sound like something a man of God would say until you remember, well, he's looking at it with God out of the picture. And when God's in the picture, it's a whole different viewpoint. And so you have to look and discern where is God in this section, if you will. He uses words over and over. First of all, he's the koaleth, the speaker, the teacher. He calls himself the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. No other person matches a son of David, king in Jerusalem. And so there's really no conflict who the writer of the book is. If you go to 1 Kings 4, I'll read a comment there. And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding exceeding much and largeness of heart, even as the sand that is on the seashore. And Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the children of the east country and all the wisdom of Egypt. And he was wiser, and then there's a list of other wise men of his day. And he spake 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. And he spake of trees, from the cedar tree that is in Lebanon, even unto the hyssop that springeth out of the wall. He spake also of beast and fowl and creeping things and fishes. And there came of all people to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all kings on earth who had heard of his wisdom. So he fits, though he's not mentioned in the book, he's inferred strongly by statements that are made. He uses a word, verse 2, Ecclesiastes 1, for those who come in. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. The NIV, the other older translations use the word vanity. Vanity, meaningless. And he uses that 38 times in the book. And what he's saying in that, and it fits a context, when God is out of the picture, there's no meaning to these things. There's no substance to them. There's no understanding to them. There's no application of wisdom that can be applied to them. So it involves several aspects of life in his response. Verse 3, what does a man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? The word gain, the word profit, is used 10 times in the book. And this question is asked from the standpoint of the value of labor, the work that we engage in, 23 times. So he sets a scene in the opening verses of subject matter that will come up in a reoccurring way. And of course, it's a great question when you ask, what does a man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? What do we gain by going to work? I want you to answer. Pay the bills. Lets us use our talents. Life is part of life. Work is part of life. There's a big discussion in the state of Alabama right now about whether Sir Nick Saban should retire. They're not winning by 40 points this year. And he has said in times past he had hip replacement surgery and other things. His wife is named Terry. He says, Ms. Terry won't let me stay in the house more than 2 days at a time. He has to go to work, is what he's saying. His wife needs him out of the house. What do you gain from all your labor? You get out of the house. And retirement is difficult for some who don't have hobbies and have ways to spend their time. So it's a worthwhile question that can be asked. And he answers it, if you will. He gives us an answer with God out of the picture, but it's a real look, if you will. What does a man gain? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. So humanity is here, and then he's not. But the earth remains. And the earth will always remain until the second coming, when there's a new earth. He says the sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. I'm amazed that there are so many in the world that have difficulty believing in God as the Creator. And they look around them, how could they not understand it? And then some scientists that will tell you that something is happening in nature this week. Whatever it might be, the aligning of sun and moon and stars and all of these things, and it hasn't happened for, and they'll tell you the exact moment that it happened before, and they'll tell you how many years will pass before it happens again. And what does that tell us? It's predictable. It's on a cycle, if you will. We appreciate and understand that, but they don't see it. They close their minds to it. Jeremy?
Yes, sir. I've been noticing recently, you know, as someone's going to tell us there's nothing new under the sun.
Yeah.
My noticing has been the qualities of God have been getting reattributed to the natural world.
Yep. Yep.
That and it's matched with lifting up kindness, lifting up graciousness. And I tell you, I've looked at that stuff and said, well, you're just taking God and calling him the universe now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're correct. It's ignoring the obvious, but it's the need to discern something about this order. You can't ignore it. You just can't ignore it when we see the predictability of things. Very specific to the moment. They can tell you to the exact moment of time. Solomon is saying the earth goes on. Things on earth go on. And the sun rises, the sun sets. The wind, verse 6, blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. Terry?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, and the idea is the reality of what we see, that it points to a designer because there's order. Terry mentioned a shoe, a table, a chair, but everything, it did not just happen. There was a source, there was a power, if you will. Verse 7, all streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. I have spent time in my past, this is maybe the fifth time I've looked at Ecclesiastes in 43 years. Somewhere I wrote down that 97% of water is in the ocean and 0.0001 is in the atmosphere. So most of the liquid, if you will, most of the water that we have is associated with the sea, the oceans. And the streams flow into the sea, and yet it's never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. And, of course, that would speak to what happens when rain falls, and eventually it gets back into the atmosphere, and clouds form, and it falls again. It speaks to some of the design, if you will, of nature. He says, verse 8, all things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, or the ear its fill of hearing. And so he's expressing reality. I won't call it frustration because I think it's just observation. But he's saying that our eyes just cannot ever see enough. Our ears, there's always something else to listen to. Tara and I eat, when possible, on the back deck, and we hear some of the strangest music, way too loud for someone who's playing it in their car with the windows up. Or you hear music from down the street that the whole block can hear. Now, here's what Chuck Swindoll said years ago when I was listening to him very often. He said, if you go up and talk to those individuals, they will act like they can just barely hear it. In other words, they have it at a volume so they can hear it. And you would say, but I can hear it four houses away. But in their mind, that's what they need to hear the music. The ear can never get full of music. And that's kind of a truism, if you will. What has been done, what has been, will be again. Verse 9. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. Now, there's new inventions. There's new thought. But in reality, much of what is part of our life is here and will be here. Not so new. Now, our generation would not suggest that. We are a generation that's just filled with so much that's new, the technology, etc. I don't know what AI is going to bring about, the gloom and doom that's been predicted, the need supposed for government, Congress, to take control, and what do they ever do well? That's a fallacy to begin with. But the concern with AI, in our generation, it's going to replace millions of people, supposedly. I don't know. It's something new. It's using the wisdom and knowledge that is there. Well, let me give you a silly example. I was watching a football game last night, and I'd never heard of one of the coaches, and so I asked Google, tell me where Jay Norvell from Colorado State coached. And within 2 seconds, I had a pretty lengthy autobiography of him. That's amazing. It's amazing that you can speak to your phone and get very specific, detailed answers to a very specific question. And who's asked it before, but the information is there. Do, 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 and boom. It just pulls it from the sources that are there. This person, this college, this university, this NFL team, whatever. We live in an exciting time. I am thrilled to be alive during these times. I hope you're not one, and it's all right if you are, but I hope you're not one who longs for the past. The past was wonderful in many ways, but the present and what's available and the technology and the doctors and all that's here for us is just amazing. It's just amazing. But it speaks to the reality there. So much of what's here seems the same. There's really nothing new under the earth or under the sun, his words, as a general realization. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? And I think what we would surmise to make that true is that anything that's new is derived from something that's already here. And I think that would be the understanding that would be encouraged. The technology that we have today is here as a result of something used and refashioned that's already been here. The something new, how often does that happen? A new approach, a new product based on what we have. But generally, that statement would be true. It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. There's no remembrance, changing the subject, verse 11, there's no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. You think that's true? Is that a truism in your mind? Do you remember people 20 years ago with any detail at all that were so important for you? What they meant to you, what they gave you, what they taught you? For the most part, we have people like that. But as a whole, I don't remember my second grade teacher. Terry does. I have no clue on some of those things. Others have great detail about these important people, and I'm sure they had an impression upon me as much as they would on someone else. But as time passes, we have less and less memories about these people of old, these people who are part of our life. We hope to attend a sibling gathering in several weeks in Tennessee. And Terry and I are starting to make a list of things that we want the eight of us, it's my seven brothers and sisters, that we want us to remember. Tell me what you remember about. And I'm curious to see what their memories are compared to mine. Things that I don't know. I just don't know. Time passes, we don't have those memories, and we would like to stir them back up. We would like to restore them, because we did at least some point know some of those things. But Solomon sets the scene. He makes some declarations, and with some variances as far as a very specific expectation or a very specific thing, generally speaking, the comments are correct. There's a great element of truth attached to them. observations before we go. Second of nine. I'm way up, and of course, half of my siblings, I wasn't there. I wasn't there when they were at home. I left. And we've had these discussions before. Tell me what you did in high school. I wasn't there. Were you in plays? Were you in the chorus? Did you compete in athletics? We didn't have cell phones. I didn't have a car in college until we were married. So much different than it would be today, but you have those conversations knowing that you missed out. It's not that you don't have the memory. You weren't there to take it in. But a good question. The middle child, we have a brother who's the middle child, and I haven't teased him because I did not hear this, but I've heard the younger siblings say, well, so-and-so acted as if he was the only child. In his mind, he was the only child. But that fits if you look at the writings and things of the middle child. The middle child is wanting things to be fair, and he's very, very diligent in those ways of thinking. It needs to be fair, and that fits the middle child of our nine. Other observations? Does it bother you, wear you out, cause you to be fearful? Let me think of other expressions. To realize that you're in the middle of a world that for the most part continues, that many things are similar decade after decade, that there's not much you can do to change things around you per se, from a general point of view. Does that give you comfort or consternation? Be curious. Liz? Yeah. 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 To me, it's comforting. I'm not unhappy knowing that tomorrow the sun's going to rise at a certain time, and I'm going to begin a day, I'll begin a week. I find comfort in some of what Solomon is suggesting. He's not offering consternation, if you will. He's just offering an observation. And in some ways, it's meaningless, vanity, but it's chasing after the wind. That's another expression that I failed to mention earlier. Chasing after the wind will come up in this book. But I'm comforted by the consistency that is found in the world around us. Well, let's look beginning at verse 12. He takes us for several chapters into different areas. They represent a pursuit, and each of them is a pursuit in order to achieve or find something. And obviously for him, wisdom would be first on the list. I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I've devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. What a heavy burden God has laid on men. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Another way of saying that in newer, older translations, a vexation of spirit. These can become a vexation of spirit. Now, what is wisdom? We need to determine what exactly would we use to describe wisdom. Yeah, it's the application of knowledge. It's the application of knowledge, a simple definition. And the more you know, what does that suggest? Heidi? That's what we would want. We would hope that would be the case. The more you know, the more you know. And you have knowledge and you're able to apply it and use what you know. But the other side of the coin, the more you know, the more you realize all that you don't know. We don't know a whole lot more than what we know. Even as a country or as a group of people in our world, the unknown is so large. But he says it's to explore wisdom, giving myself to the study of wisdom. And it lays a heavy burden. And he puts God in the picture. What a heavy burden God has laid on men. I can think of a situation. It could happen any day. It hasn't happened in my presence. It's something that might be revealed in a movie or something. But one of the smartest people in the world, they're in a dining area eating supper. And suddenly a child sitting at a table not that far away falls over, and unless something is done quickly, will likely die. Now, the smartest person in the world, with all that he knows, has no idea what to do. And I think that's a description of what some would feel and even associate it with God giving them talent, the ability to learn, the ability to put into place the things they know. But that would be quite a burden to be standing there helpless when you are so filled with information and you've used it often as wisdom in your world. It would be a heavy burden. Brian? How will you be worth something to me? Yeah. Having information and your ability to use it can become a burden. Do you understand that? Do you agree with his observation? When I was a campus minister, we had about 80 students come on Wednesday night to the college class across the street from the university. And an older gentleman would sit in on the class. And he was a great encourager to me. And we walked by the church library one night as we were leaving. And it was not a large one at all. It was just a small room with a few books, but some. And he made the observation, just think of all the information in that room. And he was saying it as a point of fact, but it also, later, he said, because you think of all that that room doesn't contain. All the information that's there somewhere, but not in there. It was a church library, so it would be a specific set of information. This is a person, he was in his early 50s, that had several patents in the Seattle area where he had lived that made him very wealthy and continued to pay him day by day because they were still being used. And I didn't know that when I first met him, but that came to pass as we got to know each other. And as I remember that statement, and as I remember the brain power that he possessed, that he produced and was appreciated and valued and brought value, so much else that we don't know. And so Solomon, with all of his wisdom, could see it as a burden that was placed on him by God. Here's this observation. It's maybe an explanation, verse 15. What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. Now, there are some things that are twisted that can be straightened. And there are some things that are lacking that can be counted. But there are so many more that these two phrases would fit. And if you're supposed to be the wisest person on earth, to come to that realization can be troubling, can cause you to feel lacking. It can certainly cause you to realize, I'm not so smart after all. Twisted cannot be straightened. Lacking cannot be counted. And it's just the reality of life. There are some things we can't undo. There are some problems we can't solve. There are some issues that we can offer encouragement. We can offer counsel. We can send them to hospitals. But addictions are sometimes difficult for the individual. With all the help, the addictions are reoccurring. And that's why it's called an addiction. And then he thought to himself, verse 16, I thought to myself, is that clock right? Good. We're going to have a little more time than I thought. I thought to myself, look, I have grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. I pondered that as we would apply it to our life circumstances. When 24-hour news became available, CNN, Fox, others, when 24-hour news became available, did it make our lives better or did it do us some harm? And I kind of answered it, if you will. Did you need to know of every airplane in the whole world that would crash? We went most of our life without knowing those things. Now we know everything about those type things. With much knowledge comes sorrow. Did we need to know details of small countries and the ethnic cleansing that would take place? It's good to know, and hopefully we did some things along the way to stop it and to educate to where those things would not happen in other worlds. But sometimes more information brings sorrow, grief. And we are encouraged sometimes when we're at our wit's end with what's happening in our world to do what? What does this represent? If it's an old television or if it's a remote control, you turn it off. Just turn it off. It doesn't stop it from happening. It doesn't solve it. But chances are you would not do things anyway. And sometimes we need to just turn the information off. It's not helping. It's making it difficult. It can push us toward depression. More wisdom, more knowledge can bring sorrow and grief. And I think we can relate to that. I'm thankful to have the resources that we have. I'm also thankful to have the common sense to choose my resources, to turn some off. I watch less news today than I ever have, but I tend to, on my tablet, I tend to read headlines. I want to keep up. I want to be aware but I don't need the banter that's associated with it so often. More sorrow, more grief, as we know more and more. Comments before we go in a different direction. We'll have time to do some justice to the subject, Harry. The squirrel, it's the squirrel in the cage, if you will. Yeah, God gives us purpose. God gives us substance. But life is daily. Life is daily. And even in the best of circumstances that we may feel that we're in, that's true. We've lived in California 3 times. In our 43 years of ministry. And I have discovered long California nights in each place. Now, where does that come from? It comes from being raised on the East Coast and living in sometimes at the Central time zone. And you're on a schedule, you watch something and it's off, and maybe now it's almost time for bed. Well, the things I watch with some rapidity are over at 8:30. And it's a long wait to go to bed. Now, yet last night was the exception. But sometimes you've finished your day and it's not time to go to bed. You can't read anymore. There's a point where you cannot work on the computer anymore that day. You cannot work, Terry, a jigsaw puzzle anymore. There's just a point to where the day, you're ready to end it. And there's that long California night waiting when it's time to go to bed. Each day is daily. Life is daily. And it's a blessing. I don't regret it, I just acknowledge it. And I'm thankful that maybe the day has been full, but I've got some time at the end to where there's nothing pressing me. That's a blessing. Being bored is a blessing. Let me tell you, being bored is a blessing if you have very full lives in many ways. Let's go on. Solomon pursues to the nth degree things in life. The first one he touches on is pleasure in chapter 2. I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is foolish. And what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself up with wine, and tasting wine is the better application of the Hebrew. Tasting wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. So to describe something as folly, he still applied wisdom to it. I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female workers, slaves, and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women singers and a harem as well. The delights of the heart of man. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. So he's not suggesting that he gave up the wisdom that would have driven these things. Now, what we're told is the parks and the projects that he brought into Jerusalem were just magnanimous. Beautiful, large, unheard of. Water aqueduct systems, it's supposed to be unheard of for that time. But of course, when you can dedicate thousands of people to accomplish it for you, it's not so impossible. We are told that he had 700 wives. Whew, that would wear me out. 300 concubines. Pleasure. And to that I have to say, I don't understand God allowing it. Why did he just say, stop that? No more. But there seems to be times when he allowed a time of ignorance compared to what would come. So I can't explain it, the wives and concubines. But here's his determination, or here's his conclusion to this part of the chapter. Verse 10, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my work, and this was the reward for all my labor. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Now that's the key, under the sun. Earthly value, God not in the picture. And that's where, as you would go forward at other times and read the book, under the sun is the key. God's not in the picture. Now, how many of you would like to have endless days, weeks, months to pursue pleasure? Whatever you enjoy, would it fill you up? Would it be fulfilling, I should say? Solomon would suggest no. You'll find that it's not fulfilling. Work has value. Accomplishment has value. It fills a void when we're feeling as if we've accomplished something rather than just having fun. So we can relate to it. It would help us to appreciate our jobs. It would help us to appreciate the things we get to do in this world. This book can help you to grow in those appreciations. We'll come back to chapter 2, beginning at verse 12, Lord willing.